Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering, in your face,
preaching. Cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah. It's the education gadfly.
Hello, this is your host Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. Here with my co-host, a man they call Tyrannosaurus Hess, Rick Hess.
I like that one, Mike. That's a little new on me, but it works.
Yeah. The guys around here, they came up with that.
Aw, they're sweet.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So, Mike, big week for you guys.
Big week for us. Released a big report today, The Proficiency Illusion. We'll talk a lot about that on the show.
Mm.
Of course, the biggest thing for me is that my wife is very, very pregnant. Could have
very
a baby
pregnant
at any moment.
You're going to be a father.
I'm going to be a father.
I'm going to call you Father Petrilli.
That would be fine. I might absolve your sins. Now, Rick, you had a big event this week. You had an event. It was called, I believe, Al Shanker, Madman, or Visionary.
A pressing question indeed.
So what's the answer?
I think the consensus was Visionary.
Huh.
It was very few votes for Madman.
And, really? You didn't have anybody on the panel voting for Madman?
No. In fact, even everybody, right and left, we had Senator Lamar Alexander and Checker were both enthusiastic proponents of Visionary.
Huh.
But so was John Cole, longtime AFT vice pres, and John Podesta of Center for American Progress.
You know what would have been interesting?
Hmm.
Is once that consensus was formed, you could have said, how about Reg Weaver?
Mm.
Huh? Anybody for Reg Weaver's a Madman?
Mm.
Think anybody would have gone for that? You know, Kobe Loop saw Reg Weaver the other day on the street.
No kidding.
Yep. Outside the NEA headquarters. So did Liam. They're on their way to Whole Foods.
Well,
it's right. By the way, we're clearly paying Liam and Kobe too much if they can afford to shop at Whole Foods. I'm going to make a personal note to remind myself about
that. Hey, by the way, though, but if any of our listeners want to catch the conversation, which was actually quite good, Senator Alexander's remarks were actually fabulous. There's a bunch of stories about his interactions with Shanker. They can go to the AI website and they can find the video cast of the event up there.
Okay. Oh, very nice. Nice plug. Okay, so listeners, this is very important. We want you to send us a note. Rick Hess, Madman or Visionary? You send us the answer at letters@edexcellence.net.
Mm.
All right, let's get going. We, of course, will play Pardon in the Gadfly. Then we're going to have an interview with John Cronin, one of the authors of The Proficiency Illusion, our new report that's out today. And finally, Liam will impart some education news of the weird. Sound good?
Works for me.
So, Christina, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Okay, so Fordham came out with this new study, right, called The Proficiency Illusion. Let's start out. Mike, what's the most surprising finding in this landmark publication?
Well, Christina, it's so hard to choose. There are several surprising findings, including the fact that states are setting their cut scores at a much higher level in math than in reading, that they're setting the bar much higher in middle school than they are in elementary school. But I have to say, I think the most surprising finding is that, indeed, there's not a race to the bottom.
Mm. What is there, Mike?
There is, instead, it seems to be a walk to the middle.
A mosey to the middle, one might say.
A mosey to the middle. You know, this what we tried to do in the study was to estimate the state cut scores using the Northwest Evaluation Association exam as a common benchmark. We did that in 2 points in time for 19 states. And at least for those 19 states, we did not see a widespread race to the bottom. We saw that most of their state tests remained relatively stable. We did see some movement, though, and where we saw movement, it tended to be the states at the very top. States like California and South Carolina, they haven't changed their tests or made any official changes to their cut scores, but we see some drift. It could be caused by lots of different things, teaching to the test and other things, but we are concerned that the states at the top seem to be the places where we see some declines in at least our estimates of cut scores.
Look at you. You're talking like a PhD, babe.
Hey, baby.
Talking like an econometrician.
Hey, man. That's right. I've been immersed in this stuff.
Cut
baby.
Scores, 2 points. You got the lingo down.
That's right, baby. That's right. But some encouraging news. Some states at the bottom, like Texas, have raised their standards in recent years. That's good news. Also, New Hampshire, this is an interesting case in point for common standards. They, in the last couple of years, joined the New England Common Assessment. This is a test that's now in New Hampshire, Vermont, and Rhode Island. And New Hampshire joined this test and actually raised its standards under No Child Left Behind.
Mike, let me make sure I got this right. You guys came out with a new study today.
We came out with a new study today. That is
okay,
correct.
Okay. I wasn't sure if I'd picked up on that thus far, but now I'm tracking. Okay.
It's a new study. That's right. All right, baby. There you go. So you didn't really get to say much about it, did you, Rick?
It's okay. I haven't read it yet. Okay. unlike my professional pundit here, I try to wait till I've actually read the darn thing. So I like that.
All right. Christina, what's next?
All right. It's Thursday now. This was a Sunday article in the New York Times Magazine that took a swipe at Teach for America, saying it's better for its participants' resumes than for kids. Is there some truth to that?
Well, I mean, certainly it has gotten to the point where it is a stellar mark on somebody's resume to be Teach for America. The question becomes, what is it we expect Teach for America folks to do? The best research on TFA shows that there are probably some, you know, real but, you know, relatively modest benefits of having a TFA teacher for the kids in these classrooms compared to the likely other candidates. Some of the other research, say Susanna Loebstuff out of New York City, leans the other way compared to, say, the mathematical work. But, you know, the fact is that TFA has also given us a whole bunch of benefits in terms of its people and the folks it's brought into education beyond their effectiveness during those 2 or 3 years in the classroom. It has given us the KIPP Academies are a consequence, the YES Academy. It has bequeathed us Michelle Rhee, who's now chancellor in D.C., and I think off to a very promising start. So the right metric is how much good is TFA doing for the kids is not just how effective are these folks in the classroom that first 2 years, but also how much energy and dynamism are these folks bringing to the education sector. And if that's the question, then I think the answer is they're doing a lot for the kids.
Wow. Rick.
Boom.
That was a comprehensive answer. I'm not sure I have anything to add. Other than to point out yet again that you have a crush on Michelle Rhee.
I do. And Wendy Kopp.
Every week. Wendy Kopp too, huh?
Wendy Kopp too, man.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, this article was, in my view, quite unfair. And it seemed to dismiss some of the people that have gone on to start charter schools as privatizers. You know, this in the New York Times Magazine, where just last spring they did a great cover story on KIPP and Achievement First and how they showed us how to close the achievement gap. Unbelievable. Mm.
Imagine New York Times being hypocritical.
Unbelievable.
Who would have thought it?
And inconsistent.
Unimaginable.
Okay, Christina.
Last one. The new Baltimore CEO of schools is already in a fight with his teachers' union over contract negotiations. Should he be applauded for this, or is it a sign of weak leadership?
Rick, I think you should take this one too, because listeners, Rick and Kobe are working on a big study of collective bargaining for the Fordham Institute.
True dat. Well said. Now, what's this actual fight over in Baltimore, Kobe?
According to the article, the teachers have 45-minute planning periods throughout the week, and I guess Alonzo wants to make one of these planning periods a collaborative planning period.
And for this, the teachers' union is going to the mat?
I gotta say.
Because the nature of one of their planning periods is being tweaked?
If this is breeding a fierce fight, then I gotta say, it sounds like a CEO who definitely needs to push, and not only push here, but presumably on a couple of other fronts as well.
I mean, this is so interesting on so many levels. First of all, when Alonzo came in, he was lauded as this educator with so much experience. He'd been a teacher. People in Baltimore were so excited. Is at the same time Michelle Rhee started in Washington, D.C., and people were saying, well, look, she's got no experience. At least we got somebody with experience. And yet she's off to, you know, a great start, is getting along well with the union chief in D.C., and now he's running into trouble. Very, very interesting stuff here. The other thing is I feel like there's a story going on here within the union strategy that we just don't understand. I mean, can they really be going to the mat over this small issue? And in a similar way, the NEA and the AFT going to battle with Chairman George Miller in the House Education and Labor Committee over this tiny little teacher incentive fund merit pay program that's going to be adopted by only a handful of districts. Reg Weaver saying that's a deal breaker on No Child Left Behind. This can't be the full story.
So you think there's a broader agenda on the part of the teacher leaders that you think they're more strategic?
Yeah, there's got to be. I think there's got to be a story here that the papers haven't been picking up on. In the case of the No Child Left Behind debate, you know, I guess I've heard some people on the Hill say that they think this is just the union's way of stalling. They don't want a bill this year. They think they're going to take their chances with that the House and Senate will be more Democratic 2 years from now, mm-hmm. and that they'll do better under a President Clinton.
Yeah, but it's funny. They could stall it out without actually planting their flag explicitly on this. They could have talked about accountability or something more broadly. So I think partly it's trying to lay a marker down on what they view as acceptable teacher compensation. And clearly, even after all this, the NEA is going to, you know, wants to be seen as diehard opposed to what Miller's putting out.
You know, they act like madmen, but maybe they're visionaries, Rick.
Ooh, Reg Weaver.
All right, it is time for our interview. Let's take a listen. Joining us today in the Education Gadfly Show is John Cronin from the Northwest Evaluation Association. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be here.
So John has been our collaborator and partner on a big study that we released today, the Proficiency Illusion. We've talked about this a little bit already in the show. So John, let's jump right in. We found that in most states, the math tests are more difficult to pass than the reading tests, especially at the eighth grade level. Some people have pushed back and said, well, is that necessarily a bad thing? What do you think?
It may not be a problem in this sense. We certainly wouldn't have an objection if there were some reason that a state believed it was important to have more difficult standards, mathematics standards than reading standards. The thing that we think is critical to it is we want people to be aware of the fact that the standards are different in difficulty and not assume that when they see a lot of kids passing a reading test and not as many kids passing a math test, that the reason fewer kids are passing the math test is because they're not performing well in math or because they're not getting as good an instruction in math as they would be in the other subject. We think people may not be aware of that fact. That's why we want to publicize differences in the difficulty of the standards.
So it's really an issue about transparency, right? Because otherwise, decision makers from superintendents down to parents might make the wrong decisions based on the information they're given.
It just seems like a good idea to let people know as clearly as possible what kids are doing before they make big decisions about them. Yeah.
Okay. Now, a similar question, where we have a finding also that most states are setting the bar much higher for eighth grade students than the bar is set for third grade students, of course, holding for their ability level and all of that. And so third graders might barely pass the test, make normal progress throughout their career, academic career, and then end up failing the eighth grade test. Again, is this a problem?
I think that's a more serious problem. And one of the reasons are, if you impose higher standards at eighth grade than you do at third, and then apply some of the accountability rules that we have in place, say the adequate yearly progress requirements on schools, one of the things you're going to find in states that have tougher eighth grade standards is you're going to see more middle schools failing to make AYP, and perhaps just as important, elementary schools making AYP, but not producing sufficient numbers of kids in those schools who are performing at a level that's going to assure they're proficient when they get to eighth grade. So in other words, we may be creating an invisible problem. You've got all these kids in third grade who look like they're doing okay, but they maintain that level of performance, get to eighth grade, and all of a sudden we discover they're not doing very well.
Yeah, and now, John, tell us one last question here. When it comes to growth models, and everybody's crazy about growth models, it looks like Congress is going to let states do growth models. This lack of so-called vertical alignment from grade to grade, is that a problem for growth models?
It'd be a problem for growth models because if you're trying to measure the progress of kids and you're setting different bars to measure that progress at different grades, then the growth model isn't going to have the same impact on every grade. And so it's not automatically a problem, but it's potentially a pretty serious problem, particularly the way we measure progress right now. Which is we're counting the number of kids who can high jump a certain number of academic feet. And if you're using that model and applying a growth model to it, you're going to have a differential effect by grade as long as these standards are in effect.
Right. I mean, that's so it's an impact on growth models, potentially on merit pay plans.
Pay would be a disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. Because again, in some grades, we're expecting much greater growth that a teacher has to get than in other grades.
Yeah. I'm worried that you have a lot of very low-paid eighth-grade teachers in some of these models, and we can't afford to lose them.
Okay, that's a great way to finish. John, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
Okay, Rick, so again, this dynamic, you heard John say, that's a real problem, that the states are setting the bar much higher in middle school than they are in elementary school, that we don't have so-called vertical alignment in these tests. What do you think? Is this as big a problem as John thinks?
So let me just make sure I got this straight. You guys came out with a new report today.
It's a new report, yes.
So there's a new Fordham report out today.
Rick, let me tell you something. Unless in the next 18 hours we capture Osama bin Laden, I think our listeners will have heard about our new report. Because nice. There was much press interest.
No, I think it. I think it sounds. I think the way John lays it out makes a lot of sense. I think this actually tracks some of the previous work from the description that's out there. Certainly, say, the Center for Education Policy study that was out earlier this spring showing dramatic raises in state scores was limited by the fact that we were talking about what's going on state assessments, trying to identify how much of that is being reflected in these other gains and getting a sense of whether that's being driven by this is
right,
key.
Right. But this second question, I mean, the point is, for some reason, the states are setting the bar dramatically higher for eighth grade kids than they are for third grade kids. And so, you know, again, kids can pass the third grade test, go on to make normal growth and fail the eighth grade test. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from our point of view, that's setting kids up to fail. Mm-hmm. The states, though, a lot of them will defend this practice.
And what's their justification for it?
Well, you know, here are different things that maybe they think that, you know, their kids are coming in with so many different skill levels into elementary school that we should set the bar lower in elementary school, give schools more time to raise the bar over time. You know, we don't want to discourage schools by the third grade, that they want to make some sort of, you know, staircase growth over time. But it just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me to send a signal to a student that, hey, you're doing fine in the third grade, if the truth is they need to really accelerate their progress in order to hit these standards later on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other way to think about it, of course, is maybe our eighth grade standards are just too darn high in this country.
Rick, look at you. Just
I think that's unlikely. But I do. I mean, but this does point out that people want to try, especially with the fancy words, they want to try to turn these the standard setting exercises into some kind of scientific process. And ultimately, these are all judgment calls and they're all normative.
But we might as well be normative at the end point, you know, what we want students to be able to know and be able to do when they're leaving our K through 12 system. Then the benchmarks along the way, I think those could be set more scientifically. You could determine what standards will predict success later on.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
All right. Now that we've probably bored our listeners to death, it is time for everybody's favorite education news of the weird. Joining us, our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
Shirley M. Katz teaches English at South Medford High School in Medford, Oregon. She also wants to carry a concealed pistol to class. Apparently, Katz is still scared of her ex-husband, and she will feel safe only if she's allowed to pack heat. District officials didn't like this idea, so Katz sued them. Concealed weapons permits are issued by the county sheriff in Oregon, and permit holders may carry a gun onto most public properties, including schools, without violating state law. Most school districts, though not all of them, ban teachers from bringing handguns to class. That, according to Katz, is a travesty, one that needs correcting. And that's education news of the weird.
Okay, I'm confused. So what's the resolution here?
She sued.
But she sued them. Is she carrying her gun or not?
Why, I assume she's not allowed to carry it.
Well, this is probably of significant interest to her students at a minimum. Well, we need this kind of information.
Well, the key is it's concealed. You wouldn't know one way or the other.
Well, now, so you wonder why she sued instead of, let's face it, why is she conceal the weapon.
Mm.
I mean, nobody will know. I mean, look, unless there's is there a
metal detector may be in the front doors.
Look, I mean, I have some sympathy for her. I mean, look, this is a serious thing. People that are being threatened, domestic abuse, that's very scary. And if the state has said that it's okay for people to conceal weapons on public property, who are school districts to just, you know?
Well, I mean, her husband apparently said that he's just really into his new photography career.
Mm.
What?
That's what he said in the article.
Why wasn't that in your story?
And so he's taking pictures of it?
I was trying to hone it to the base of the facts.
Wait, you mean he's like sneaking up on her and taking pictures?
No. He's a professional photographer now. He was a substitute teacher. Now he's a photographer. And he said, you know, that he's just really into, you know, pictures.
Why is that not a non sequitur, though? Presumably he's using a telephoto lens to take lots of shots from her from like.
No, that's not the presumption.
Of course.
The presumption is innocence in this nation.
Okay, but no, the real presumption here is, let's talk for a moment just about the reading style that you utilized there. What the heck was that about?
Sometimes I get a little bored halfway through and I try to mix it up, you know, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Dude, it was like you were spasmodically deciding word to word how much emphasis and how fast to read it.
Well, the part that I read fast, it kind of sounded to me like it was legal, kind of boring, so I tried to hurry through it. That was it.
Yes, but then... That was something.
Well, I think there's another solution to this problem, is that this teacher should go to work in a virtual school.
Mm.
Then there's no problem. She can keep the gun. She can stay at home. She can still teach. And that is all the time we have for this week. So thank you, Liam, for an education news of the, I guess it was weird. I think it's a little, I don't know, I'm a little torn. I think this is a real conundrum. But that is all the time we have for next week. We'll be joining you next week unless my baby boy comes along.
I'm going to be away next week anyway, babe.
Oh, is that right?
So you guys can do it without me.
Thanks for telling us, right? Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, all right. Well, we might be back with a different guest host who might become our permanent host. That's the point. Okay. Until then, who are you, Rick?
I'm Rick Ed.
And I'm Mike Petrilli. I'm confused. I'm signing off.